Hi, this is David Locke, host of Locked On NBA, founder of the Locked On Podcast Network. Kevin Pelton is your guest today. It's everyone's favorite, at K Pelton on Twitter. Send him a thank you. He does amazing work on ESPN Insider. You can grab him there. He is fabulous. So make sure you send him a big thank you, at K Pelton, for joining the show. This is a really good conversation. We get philosophical about pace and what it's doing to offensive rebounding and free throw rates, and then we jump through and a bunch of content on teams. It's one of the favorite ones we've ever done before. Make sure you have subscribed to your favorite NBA team's Locked On podcast. We give them to you daily. Every Monday on Locked On NBA, we're covering the biggest stories with the local experts. So if you didn't catch this week, we touched in on Boston, Denver, and Cleveland. What's going on there? Enough of that. Today's show is brought to you by SeatGeek. Use the promo code LOCKED and you get a $20 rebate on your first purchase. And by Draft. Have you ever played Draft? It is the most fun fantasy game. You can play with your buddies or you can join our Draft. Promo code LONBA. Download the app Draft. You can play it. It's daily fantasy, but you do snake drafts instead of salary cap, and it's super fun. We have an exclusive Locked On Fantasy Draft for right now for $3 entry, and if you use the promo code LONBA, you get that entry for free. So go join it and have fun today playing Draft. Let's get the show underway.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Kevin Pelton, as I said earlier, everybody's favorite. If I'm going to start anywhere with you, you do this incredible thing where every single time there's a trade, you are able to, in no time, have the trade report out. We've had the trade of Eric Bledsoe. So without ruining your own story that you do, and just a tip of the hat to you for this, and by the way, everybody, the minute trade goes down, start searching Pelton and getting ready for it because he'll have it out there. What is your take on how much better this makes Milwaukee and what it does for Milwaukee?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like maybe I underestimated it when I first looked at it because of the fact that I think, you know, probably a lot of my reaction to the trade was driven by the fact that, you know, if the Bucks had made a trade for Bledsoe, I was assuming that they were going to be giving up, you know, Mirza Teletovic or John Henson, you know, maybe Dellavedova, one of those guys at the salary in return, and not Greg Monroe, who was a very important part of their team in terms of the scoring punch he provided off the bench and just giving them a center with, you know, much in the, who basically had to be guarded. But, you know, Bledsoe is a really good player and immediately becomes either the second or third best player on the Bucks, depending on what you think of him relative to Chris Middleton. So, you know, this is a pretty big addition. The one thing I didn't really get into in the trade grades, I'm curious to talk to you about. It seems like there's this trend of teams with young superstars loading up to try to win now instead of doing it while those stars are at their peak. Have you noticed this?
And does this stem back to Chris Bosch and Gordon, you know, starting with Chris Bosch and then finishing last year with Gordon Hayward, that they'll leave? And so the panic is that if you don't do enough at this stage, they're going to leave you?
I think that might be part of it. So Anthony Davis is probably the most extreme example of this, where, you know, after his one season in the league, New Orleans trades two first-round picks to get Drew Holiday, brings in Tyreke Evans to go with Eric Gordon, and all of a sudden, you know, they've got this really expensive team that then, you know, they kind of, they were pot committed basically, and they kept throwing first round picks at trying to trade for veterans to add to it. And then now we've gotten to the point where, you know, the DeMarcus Cousins trade was something of a lifeline for them, but still they've got Cousins and Davis who now have been great together, and really not much else right now. Then, you know, Minnesota last offseason, I think, is another example of this. The Jimmy Butler trade may have forced their hand where, you know, trading for a star with 2 years on his contract, you sort of have to go on his timeline instead of the timeline of the Towns and Wiggins. But they, you know, go out and sign Jeff Teague and Taj Gibson, and now all of a sudden you've got all these old guys around Towns and Wiggins. And then, you know, Milwaukee, it's not going to be as extreme. They held on to Malcolm Brogdon. They still have Jabari Parker. You know, Thon's got a lot of upside. But, you know, they are a team whose star is, what, 23? I don't know off the top of my head what Giannis is now, but who traded for a guy who's about to turn 28.
So what do you think the right answer is?
I don't know. I mean, there may not be a right answer, but it's just interesting to me that all of these teams are sort of doing this. I mean, I guess the contrast would be Oklahoma City, where they had, you know, with the way the Harden trade played out, getting, you know, young guys in return, and specifically Steven Adams, who has now become an important core piece for them. You know, their plan was always to kind of go slowly with Durant and Westbrook and, you know, peak when those guys were peaking, which, you know, from a financial standpoint, now they're doing with Westbrook, but they don't have Durant. So maybe they waited too long. Maybe this is the right approach.
And then Indiana was a weird one because Paul George came along while they had an established crew and got caught in the middle of the rebuild with Paul George. I would tell you, as an observer, I listen to these general managers and they lay out these plans, and I think that it's impressive. And I'm always admire the ones that can stay to it, unlike a Phoenix who freaks out halfway through and just completely goes off the rails. But then I watch how many things can go wrong in the meantime. And frankly, if we're playing the odds, the chances are Dante Exum's going to tear an ACL somewhere along the way. Right? Like, I mean, Dennis Lindsay's in Utah, where I'm obviously connected. He's done things really quite terrifically. But Dante Exum tore an ACL and then fell on a shoulder. And that's really screwed things up. And so maybe the answer is to add the 27-year-old Eric Bledsoe or go a little bit more with urgency, just because there's so much player movement and so much can go wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question then is just, you know, how high is your peak going to be with those players? Because, I mean, the real problem in New Orleans is not necessarily that they tried to win too early with Anthony Davis. The problem is they tried to win too early with Anthony Davis and they haven't won a playoff game with him.
Right. And and maybe their problem is they made bad moves.
Right. There's a strategy and an execution component to this. So, you know, maybe it'll work out better for Milwaukee. I mean, I guess the contrast here, you know, I mentioned Oklahoma City, but it would really be Philadelphia, where even though they've added veterans, just the sheer nature of the number of draft picks they accumulated means that they've got all these young guys around the core of Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid, and maybe who knows what's going to happen, but maybe someday Markelle Fultz.
Right. And then, you know, if you're a free agent and you look at Giannis and you look at these, you're probably pretty interested, right? These are guys, as you get older, you might want to play with. I don't know who you are at that point, but I don't know, you know, how many places LeBron's going or Kevin Durant's going or some of these other guys as they get older. But those are pretty enticing pieces to add to the mix. What do you on this discussion, which I wasn't entirely prepared for, but it's interesting. What about Denver and Millsap? Because that doesn't match Jokic, Harris, and Murray or Moutier at all.
Yeah, I mean, and that is very true. I mean, I think that might be a case where it was kind of like, we have this cap space. We know it's going to go away soon because these guys get expensive. So let's go get the best part we can. And if that's an older guy, so be it, because you know, he's going to come off the books in a couple of years, right when our young guys are starting to get expensive.
And yet he's using an awful lot of possessions that could go to other guys. What's the loss value there?
I'm not as ready to put that on Millsap as you are.
All right. We'll see what happens. If they play Brooklyn every night, they'll be all right, evidently. If they can get Brooklyn on the back end of a back-to-back going to altitude, they'll be fine every night. Who's the best offensive player in the NBA so far this year? I think this is...
I mean, it's probably Steph Curry, right?
No, it's not right now. I think this is like the untalked about story, actually. It's LeBron James. He's unbelievable right now.
Yeah, I guess he does have a slightly higher offensive rating in warp than Curry does. I just think Curry like has been again so slept on that he is doing what he's doing again. But yeah, I mean, for LeBron to be doing, you know, the 57-point game, you know, the other night, I mean, how incredible was that?
Yeah, he's shooting 60%.
66 on twos, 37 on threes.
I mean, what are you doing?
And he's playing point guard for them. He has a higher assist rate than Steph.
And how many minutes has he played? Like, this is never...
Too many?
But I mean, this has never been done. This is blowing. I mean, to the Westbrook triple double and the Harden. This, for someone to have played 41,000 career regular season minutes and then play at this level, like, it's not even close. Like, I've done the research on this. 40,000 is like, put the tombstone up. There's a few guys recently who've maintained some ability, but that's a big number when you start looking at the history of the game of 40,000 minutes and where guys are in their career when they've played 40,000 minutes. And this is incredible.
The VersaClimber is pretty good, I guess.
The VersaClimber, but whatever it is, I'm doing it all just so I can, like, do an eighth of it. Like, I mean, like, if you look at the other guys in the league, by the way, right now who've played 40,000 minutes, it's Dirk Nowitzki, Vince Carter, Joe Johnson, Jason Terry, Pau Gasol. No, that's it. Like, that's it. Dirk Nowitzki, Vince Carter, Joe Johnson, Jason Terry. Like, those guys, I admire them all. But, like, shadows, right? Not even shadows. Like, this, they're eclipse. There is no shadow for them of what they once were as players. And here's LeBron at that level doing that. It's incredible.
I mean, it is sort of different when you're adding those, layering those 40,000 on top of a couple of years of NCAA experience. And, you know, age generally is more predictive than mileage, but my research has found that, you know, there is some additional wear and tear due to, you know, if you came into the league early, basically, and played all those minutes at a young age, and nobody did it quite like LeBron. I mean, you know, we'll see what happens with changes in the age limit, but this is probably a one-of-a-kind career.
Yeah, I mean, really, and I just hope we're cherishing it. I remember when I used to go home so I could watch at satellite 5.277 on my huge dish that took up half my backyard and watch every Jordan game that ever happened. I hope we're the same place with LeBron, that we're watching these games at that level.
It's hard to have that mindset in 2017.
It is. Number one conversation on every national, all 27 national NBA podcasts is, oh my gosh, the pace of play. But I've yet to hear anyone discuss the impact of the pace of play. What's the impact of the 4 to 5 possessions faster game we're playing this year than we did a year ago?
I don't know.
Thanks.
I do know one impact, which is that if you're comparing like box score stats, to think box score stats from the last two decades, it's like this huge advantage now for players now. So it's like, you know, X players have had, you know, averaged 20 points per game with whatever. Like, the 20 points per game is very different now. I mean, part of minutes per game has also decreased, so that offsets it a little bit. But 20 points per game is very different now than it was in 2004.
In the sense, it's not as impressive.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That, like, you know, this is something I wrote about last year. It was, you know, people said, oh, this MVP race, it's so amazing. We've got this Westbrook triple-double, Harden, what he's doing, you know, Kawhi and LeBron. And then you looked at it and it was like, well, this is actually a pretty average year in terms of the value in advanced stats and the top guys, other than, you know, Westbrook broke box plus minus. So he was off the charts there. But, you know, part of what was happening is people were evaluating it based on the per game stats. And even at that point, the pace was kind of inflating that a little bit. And now it's even more so.
When you look at what's happening with the game, one of the things that's happened is about 3-4 years ago, 27% of all rebounds were offensive. And last time I checked, that number's down to about 22%. What is the impact of the drop in offensive rebounds? The reason is clear. People have valued getting back in transition over that. Now, what's interesting about that is there was a paper at Sloan recently that didn't necessarily say that was the greatest strategy. What do you think the impact of the offensive rebound rate drop, and what does it mean about offensive rebounding?
Well, it's interesting because I think there's a couple of factors at play here. The first is obviously that emphasis on transition defense, but the other is also, inevitably, as you shoot more threes, more guys are out on the perimeter. They're not in positioned offensive rebound. And, you're playing smaller lineups with guys that are probably weaker offensive rebounders. And even though it's three-pointers, you're more likely to offensive rebound those than mid-range jumpers. They're not nearly as likely to be offensive rebound as shots around the basket. So, actually, I guess the rate of shots around the basket hasn't really changed. It's mostly that you're trading mid-range jumpers for threes. But if you've got all those guys on the perimeter, it does become harder to offensive rebound. Like, we usually see this more in college basketball where, you know, there are some teams, my insider colleague John Gasway coined the term perimeter-oriented teams to describe them, where they shoot a bunch of threes, never get any offensive rebounds, et cetera. And the NBA is progressively looking more like those teams. Now, the interesting thing, and I don't think this explains very much of the change in pace, but, you know, because of the way that we define a possession is the continuous time a team holds the ball, including offensive rebounds, if you have fewer offensive rebounds, by definition, the possessions are going to be shorter, and that is one factor in the pace increasing.
I'm beginning the points after an offensive rebound are so high. I'm beginning to think that if somebody can figure out how to offensive rebound at a high rate, it's going to have a larger impact than it used to have, and that there's a value to it.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about that paper. That definitely indicated the team should be crashing the glass more than they are, because, you know, sending an extra offensive rebounder was on average generating more points through second chances than you were giving up in terms of transition opportunities. But coaches are very conservative, and I think they're more likely to feel like, just really feel the pain of that transition opportunity that they think is because of the fact that someone crashed the offensive glass, than they are to appreciate the easy points that are generated by a putback.
So the best offensive rebounding teams in the NBA right now are the Clippers at 28%, the Knicks at 27%, Enes Kanter, Portland at 26%, San Antonio at 26%, and Minnesota at 25.8%. League average is actually, the median team is down to about 21.6%. So it's actually even slipping more than and I anticipated. I don't know if there's anything to take from it, but the Clippers are the fourth best offensive team. The Knicks are 11th, Portland's 14th, and Minnesota's 7th. If you look at the top 8 offensive rebounding teams right now in the league, all of them are in the top half offensively, except for San Antonio, who's 19th.
Portland is kind of fascinating because they're a team that we don't think of like this. We think, you know, you think of their offense, you think of Lillard and McCollum and the great scoring that they get from their backcourt and their shooting, but their offense has really stayed their offense has struggled a little bit in ways that I think that will regress to the mean, but they've really stayed afloat by doing everything but shooting well. They're 25th in effective field goal percentage and 14th in offensive rating.
This is kind of an interesting. Portland's 25th, San Antonio's 26th, and yet both of them are kind of above because they're offensive rebounding.
Right. Which, you know, way back in John Hollinger's first edition of the Pro Basketball Prospectus, he posed a question about whether, you know, bad shooting teams are likely to be better offensive rebounding, which I guess makes some sense in terms of, you know, there's going to be more value to the second chance if A, they're to offensive rebound, if A, there are more missed shots to rebound, and B, you have more need for those points because of the fact that you're not making the first shot.
This is interesting. Clippers are 17th in the league in shooting and 4th in the league in offense.
Yeah. And that's a team that Doc Rivers historically has been one of those coaches who has really prioritized getting back over hitting the offensive glass. And I wonder, you know, if his philosophy has changed, whether he feels like they need more easy points now that they don't have Chris Paul.
Is there anything to, I mean, obviously shooting is the most important of the four factors. The four factors are effective field goal percentage, free throw rate, turnover rate, and offensive rebounding rate. If you weigh, when Dean Oliver writes basketball on paper, how do they weigh out the importance of these four factors? And is that all we're talking about, that maybe that has to be altered a little bit?
Yeah, no, I mean, I looked at that 2 years ago when I was doing some of the research about, you know, the shot quality versus shot making. And my recollection at the time is that the value of the four factors is not very different than what Dean had found, you know, when he wrote that, which is, you know, that shooting is by far the most important. I think, you know, about half of all the variation in offense really can be explained just by shooting. The other three are more closely gathered together in terms of what they explain and all much more.
All right, so inside these four factors is free throw rate, and I know you've been working on a project involving free throw rate. What are you looking at?
Yeah, I mean, free throw rate around the league is down a little bit, which it has gone progressively over time. I think that's, you know, another trend along with the trend towards less offensive rebounding. But stars in particular are not attempting as many free throws as they did last season. You've seen that James Harden's foul rate is way down. Russell Westbrook, much to his chagrin, I was there in Portland the other night when Carmelo Anthony got ejected for the flagrant two, and afterwards the Thunder were complaining about, you know, not just that call, but also the fact that they don't feel they've been getting the foul calls in general that they deserve, and there may actually be some merit to those claims.
All right, is the merit to the claims that they're not getting the foul calls they deserve, or they got too many foul calls before?
I can't unpack that. No, I think it's more the latter, more the former, though.
Do you think, is it league-wide to the point where you think it might be a point of emphasis on the officials, or you think it's just a quirky sample size?
I think it probably has something to do with the so-called Harden rule, changing the definition of when you get a shooting foul on contact, you know, going up to shoot a three or coming over a screen to shoot a three.
I like that rule, by the way.
Me too.
I mean, it was just dreadful last year, so I have a hard time complaining about it. All right, we'll find some more trends that Kevin's seeing in a second. I want to tell you, today's Draft Wednesday on the Locked On Podcast Network. Draft is so fun. If you love fantasy basketball, you'll love this, but it's better because it's daily, but it's not like the other guys. You do live snake drafts with other people. So you can find your buddies, six of them, eight of them, 10 of them, four of them, one of them. You go head-to-head, however you want to do it. You build the draft as you want. Then you do a snake draft. You draft five players, a center, two forwards, two guards. Look it over. Look who's playing that night. Sometimes you're better off drafting centers or forwards early. And the drafts start every couple minutes. You can also join other people's drafts. There's just a lobby of them. And in that lobby, by the way, you'll see our exclusive Locked On Fantasy Draft. Use the promo code LONBA. That's LONBA to get in. And you're playing for cold hard cash. Drafts start for just a dollar. It's so fun. No salary caps, just a snake draft. So go to it. Draft.com on your computer or the app Draft in the iTunes or the Android store. I've really found this to be a great deal of fun. I think you'll use it as well. Play for real money for free just for using the promo code LONBA and get your first deposit on Draft now. All right, so we've talked pace. I've been talking offensive rebounding. I'm always in my own world. You're seeing free throw rate. Any other trends here in the first 10, 11, eighth of the season?
The growth of threes is a little bit less than it was last year, you know, 2015-16 to 2016-17, but obviously we're going to set new records again for how many threes get shot around the league. That's not showing signs of stopping anytime soon.
How about Toronto? 72% of their shots are either in the restricted area or in the or threes? Like, what happened to this team?
Yeah, it's interesting. So despite the fact that they're not actually shooting the three that well, 32% so far, they're sixth in offensive rating.
What's the whole make-or-miss game here? Defenses, the numbers have smaller deviation. Offenses, you are who you are. As you look early and you see that Boston's allowing 30% from three and Orlando, I think, is at something around there, and that, or a team like we ran into Houston. I mean, I knew we were in trouble. Houston was last in the league in three-point shooting. I was like, oh, it's going to bust some point. I bet it busts tonight because, you know, everyone's glass is half empty. What is the truth on when you look at a league as a make-or-miss league and then where the standard deviation points are offensively versus defensively?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I looked at last year but never really got to a point where I could write anything about it was, you know, is it the case that three-point percentage in an individual game is going further towards determining who wins that game than in the past? And, there does seem to be a slight trend towards that where, you know, if there are more threes getting shot than who happens to be shooting them better that particular night, it really becomes more of a three-point shooting contest than the other factors. You know, it's still the other stuff matters. It's not a perfect thing. But over time, gradually, obviously, that has become more important as teams have shot more threes.
Is there an undervalued element in this league right now in your mind? Is there something you're seeing where you're like, you know what, if I was in the front office again, which Kevin was at one point, I'd really be pushing this, or people are missing the boat on this? Do you see something out there you think's undervalued?
Nothing leads to mind thinking about the first couple weeks of the season. I mean, this isn't undervalued, but one interesting trend is, you know, the size of ball handlers with Ben Simmons coming onto the scene and doing what he's doing. And then Giannis playing the role that he is. And we mentioned LeBron playing point guard in Cleveland. Like, the ability for these 6'8" or bigger guys to handle the ball and effectively operate as point guards is, you know, we haven't seen this many players doing it probably, Blake Griffin being another one, this many players doing it probably ever.
Right, now I'm going to some of the questions I had for you that I was prepared for. Is the play of Victor Oladipo and Domantas Sabonis an indictment on Russell Westbrook?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I was watching Doug McDermott the other night in New York, and I don't think he's been great overall, but had that same thought about, wow, all these guys that we thought were so terrible last season are doing useful things this year. I don't think that Victor Oladipo is doing is sustainable. So, you know, we've seen Oladipo in a larger role before in Orlando. You know, it's not like he's been playing with Russell Westbrook his entire career. I mean, certainly I think that didn't turn out to be as good of a pairing as the Thunder hoped it would be. But, you know, it's hard for me to really say that, you know, the Thunder would have been better off with Oladipo getting a lot more touches and shots last year. I don't think that would have been the case.
Sabonis
is interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, you want to jump in here?
Well, last year he took 27% of his shots as threes and was terribly inefficient. And this year he's taking 2% of his shots as threes and he's terribly efficient. And it's the exact contrast to everything that we're doing with big men in this league right now.
Yeah, I mean, now with Sabonis, it's a lot more than just whether he's playing with Westbrook or not. Now he's playing almost exclusively, if not exclusively, at center. I think he might have, you know, maybe played a little bit with Miles Turner since Turner has been back. So instead of having to, you know, pick and pop to the three when he screens on the ball because of the fact that Steven Adams is, you know, around the basket crowding that space, and then they have Andre Robertson, two teams are not guarding. So they really needed him to shoot threes in that role. He was kind of terribly miscast in it. You know, had a few moments early in the season where he shot threes better than we expected, but you know, nobody looked at Sabonis at Gonzaga and said, "Hey, this guy's going to come into the league and he's going to be the next Ryan Anderson. He's going to be Lauri Markkanen." Like, no, that wasn't what people were projecting for him. They were projecting him to, you know, be a high percentage finisher, maybe someone who eventually could score in the post as he did in college, good putbacks, and that's kind of the role he's been freed to play now. I think the question that's going to happen that we're going to have with Sabonis is he going to be good enough defensively as a center to justify playing him there and taking advantage of his offensive skill? You know, if we get more data on his defense, are we going to start to see him as more of an Enes Kanter type, or can he be good enough defensively to hold up at center and this amazingly efficient score?
The flip side of this is using my PAC rating. Last year, Paul George used 20 scoring opportunities a night and was 1.4 points above average. This year, Paul George is using 19 scoring opportunities a night and is 0.4 points below the average player in the NBA. So Russell Westbrook is having a negative impact on Paul George. And this is all from the guy, by the way, and I want to clarify that. I generally don't believe that teammates impact other teammates' efficiencies. Carmelo is going to keep proving that for me well right now. What's your thought on the flip side of it, that there's a chance it's going the other way?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting because Georgia's shooting really well from three. I mean, the issue is more that he's not getting the free throw line at all, which also comes up briefly in that piece that I mentioned that I'm working on, that he has not been getting called for fouls, drawing fouls as frequently as he has in the past. His career is free throw rate is about half of what it was last season. So that's one factor in his efficiency being down early in the season. And then the other one is the fact that, you know, he shot 48% on long twos last year. He's at 39% this year. 39% honestly is probably more indicative of his true ability than the 48%. So, yeah, I mean, and Paul George is not someone who necessarily last year was what a career high in terms of true shooting percentage. This year is much closer to his career average than last year was.
And then Russell Westbrook is really terribly inefficient. Unless I've done something wrong, I can't get any player tracking numbers for this year yet. I don't know if I'm searching wrong. But I'm fascinated to watch it because if you looked at Russell Westbrook last year, in the first 6 seconds of the shot clock, which he somehow, I mean, this is incredible, he used 25% of his possessions. And he shot about 52% as effective field goal percentage, about 56%. He only used 10% of his possessions in the final 7 seconds of the shot clock, and he shot 32%. Like, his drop as the shot clock goes is as severe as anyone in the league. And when I'm watching him the first few games, he's pushing and then curling out because he feels like that's what he's supposed to do. He's now walking himself into the second half of the shot clock and even the bottom third where he's no longer efficient. And I don't have the data this year on whether – last year he only used 10% of his possessions in the bottom – 7 seconds of the shot clock, but I mean, he shot 32% in those. An effective field goal percentage, I believe, was about 39-40. So he was really poor. And I think those numbers are going to be way up. I'm guessing that his 25% first 6 seconds of the shot clock is going to be at about 16%, and his 10% in the last 7 seconds is going to be at about 15%. Because of this. And it's really what you've suddenly done is not only given possessions to less efficient players like Carmelo, but you're no longer letting Russell use possessions in the way that he's best.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's not something I've noticed watching them play, but I'll keep an eye out for it. I mean, what's interesting about Westbrook is he's shooting, you know, basically the same from the field as he did last year, but his efficiency is way down overall because, as I mentioned, his free throw rate is way off. And then also, for some reason, shooting like 61% from the free throw line. I know there's been some talk in Oklahoma City that, you know, his routine was thrown off by the change they made this year where you're not allowed to go outside the three-point line to slap, to high-five your teammates between free throws. And apparently he went back to doing that last night.
Oh, interesting, because I was listening to Carson Cunningham, our host of Locked On Thunder, and he was talking about how much Westbrook's bothered by that and missed the three free throws in Portland.
Yep.
So now he's daring the league to give him a delay a game?
I guess so.
They're probably going to do it. I mean, if they're trying to really institute this rule, they got to do it, right?
Yeah, you would think. I'm surprised they didn't. If he did, in fact, do it last night.
By the way, I would point out Carmelo is almost exactly as inefficient in Oklahoma City as he was in New York. Like, for all the talk of Olympic Carmelo, he's just a bad offensive player at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing that everyone forgets about Olympic Carmelo is that Melo wasn't very good in the 2016 Summer Olympics. It was really in 2012 and 2008 that we're talking about.
That's a long time ago.
Indeed it is.
I mean, I'm on my island on this. I just think the Carmelo addition, I had them as like arguably second in the West. I think I had them second in the West. I put them to sixth when they added Carmelo. I think it does everything I just said. I think it pushes Russell late into the shot clock. I think it takes 20 possessions a night out of either Paul George or Russell Westbrook, who are either average or well above average, and suddenly are being used by a significantly below average player. I'm on my island. I mean, I just don't – everyone's talking about, oh, like every broadcast I listen to, oh, when they figure it out – no. When they figure it out, they're still going to be less good because 20 possessions a night are being used by a guy who's well below average.
Yeah. I still think there may be a little something there.
Like, what do you think a little something is?
I mean, now the one thing that has happened is Melo is often playing with the second unit, and the second unit has been dramatically improved from last season in terms of, you know, where they basically got destroyed anytime Westbrook was on the bench.
Yeah, but why wouldn't you play Paul George with the second unit? Because he's actually an efficient offensive player.
Well, I mean, this year he hasn't necessarily been, but I mean, I don't know if I've seen a big difference, whether it's Melo or Paul George in that role.
We're about to go rapid fire around the league with Kevin Pelton, thanks to our sponsor, SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the number one place for you to buy or tickets to any event you might go to. It's really easy. Download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, enter the promo code LOCKED. Now, when you find the event you want to go to, you're going to get a $20 check sent back to you. Why you're going to use SeatGeek? One, because they compile all the tickets from all the area in one spot for you. Remember when you used to have to call all around? No more. You now know. Number two, they give you a ticket value, a ticket rating on every single ticket in there, so you know which are the best value, best seats. You can look at the stadium, the arena, the venue, and see what they are. And then number three, it's secured, and it's on your phone right there, so you don't have to do anything else. It's taking something that used to be a pain, using technology, and making it super easy. That's what SeatGeek has done. With the promo code LOCKED, you get $20 back on your first rebate. They've been a great sponsor of ours. Please support them. It's where I get my tickets and use SeatGeek all the time to get to whatever event I want to go to, and I hope you do the same. Download the SeatGeek app. Enter in the promo code LOCKED. You get $20 back on your first rebate. On your first purchase, excuse me. You get a $20 rebate on your first purchase. Few quick things, and then we'll start to wrap up. Can Boston sustain this?
The 9-game winning streak, no. Being the number one seed in the East, I'm coming around on it. I mean, they've certainly benefited from opponents missing a lot of threes early in the season, as I think you mentioned at one point. And some of their guys are shooting unsustainably well from the three, most notably Jason Tatum. So, I think one of the big concerns we had about them when Gordon Hayward went down is, are they going to have enough shooting now, around Kyrie with, they're often starting a, Aaron Baines at the five and, Tatum and Brown. You didn't look at them as knockdown shooters coming into the season, but both of those guys are shooting really, really well from three so far. We'll see how much of that continues.
The team I just love is Toronto. So, and let me see if I can explain it both numerically and eyesight. First of all, my number one rule is I want a team. My ultimate goal is to have a team that has everybody off of it that uses possessions below the league average. So the guys who used possessions below the league average last year significantly were Damari Carroll, PJ Tucker, Corey Joseph, Fred Van Vliet, and Jared Sullinger. So they got rid of four of the five.
Now, I don't know if Jared Sullinger used that many possessions.
Yeah, right. I mean, he was just on my list. Okay, so yeah, he used his 0.7 or his four possessions a game for his 11 games of the year. Now, what's interesting is the guy using Norman Powell's below average right now, which he was not. A year ago, he was average. And then Kyle Lowry is well below average, and OG is below average, which is a rookie. And if they can get somebody to play instead of Van Vliet, then they'll solve what I want. The other one is they have too many players, but I love their rotation. Like watching them.
The second unit is a blast.
And the way Casey's using it. So the starters play, and then they go to four bench guys with DeRozan for a while, and then they go to five bench guys, and you're right. It is just a blast. And Siakam's good, by the way. And can put it on the. I didn't know he could put it on the deck like that. And then they come back with Lowry and the four bench players, and then they finish with whatever combination, usually Siakam at the four, and I'd probably play Pirtle in front of Bebe, but who cares? I tell you what, that is 240 minutes of quality minutes of basketball right there. I love that team. That's my number one seed in the East. I feel comfortable about it. Lowry's got to get going. He's shooting 30 whatever percent, but heck, they're winning and he's shooting 30 whatever percent.
You know what I'm excited about is a Kyle Lowry stat, and that is that he's averaging 30.8 minutes per game after playing 37.4 last year and 37.0 the year before. Because before, it was always that rotation you mentioned was DeRozan and the four bench guys who typically got outscored, And then at the start of the second quarter, Casey would bring in Lowry with the four bench guys, and they would absolutely demolish teams. And that was basically the only reason they were good, is like their starting lineup was okay. DeRozan and the four bench guys were okay-ish, but probably a little worse than okay. And then Lowry and the four bench guys were otherworldly good. So for them to be able to sustain a few minutes per game, a few minutes per half at least, with no Lowry, with all five bench guys, has really cut down his minutes. And I think that'll be huge for them because he was playing way too many in the past.
Houston. Now, I was in there for one of the greatest nights an offensive player's ever had in NBA history, and it was incredible. And so I'm definitely skewed by that. I mean, recency bias here. But what jumped out to me is I think we've discussed the Houston situation with Chris Paul incorrectly. It's not a how is are James Harden and Chris Paul going to gel, because James Harden is awesome, and so it's James Harden's world, and we're living in it. It's how is Chris Paul and Eric Gordon going to both be effective at the same time?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, they didn't play together because Chris Paul got traded for Eric Gordon.
Right.
I mean, Gordon has played that off-ball role in the past. I don't think that'll necessarily be a problem for him, but boy, is he going well right now.
I mean, he looks terrific. His dunk numbers are kind of heading back up to when he looks terrific. I mean, and so, but he's playing right now. He's getting a few minutes a night with the ball in his hands, and that seems to engage him at a pretty high level. And he's also playing a decent amount, right? I mean, I guess you could go, he's playing 33 minutes a night. When Chris Paul comes back, I don't think Eric Gordon's playing 33 minutes a night.
Yeah, I mean, you might like to scale that back a little, quite frankly, given his injury history. I think what's interesting to me is we've talked about two teams now that are fifth and sixth in the league in offensive rating, despite the fact that neither of them is shooting three at a league average rate, but they're both shooting a ton of threes. So this gets back to one of my points in the past, which is that oftentimes just shooting the three is more important than making the three because of how it opens up the offense for everyone else. And lo and behold, what you find is that Houston so far this year is shooting two-pointers at a higher rate than the Golden State Warriors. They're making almost 60% of their twos as a team. Wow. That is unbelievable.
Wow. Unsustainable?
Probably, but I think the improvement from three will make up for that.
By the way, do you know that – I think my numbers are right on this. Do you know that James Harden missed his first 20 shots this year in the paint non-restricted?
I did not know that. That's interesting.
And I'll tell you, I've never prepped for a game more pulling up numbers and going, oh, dear. Oh, dear.
The gambler's fallacy is not real. Fuck.
The what is not real?
The gambler's fallacy is not real.
Really? Why not? And I still didn't understand what the hell the Wyatt Earp is, and I live on Wyatt Earp Drive, by the way, from reading your piece last week.
Should I try to explain it to you?
No, but wait. Why is that not real? Why when you have – wait, when you have a player – who has a set standard of performance, right? So I've got enough data on James Harden that I naturally can understand that he's going to regress to the mean. So why is that not real?
But the regress to the mean means too many means. You expect them to perform at that previous level going forward. And because of the fact that he's been below that level, it will bring him back towards that level. But I don't know. I've never studied this specifically in sports, but in general, the reason the gambler fallacy is so, to unpack this a little more, it's, you know, oh, it's, you know, the roulette wheel has landed on red 10 times in a row. Now it's due to land on black next time because it hasn't. And the roulette wheel obviously doesn't care where it has landed in the past. It's only the statistical probability of where it's going to land in the future. So it's not any more likely to land on, you know, black instead of red because of the fact that it hasn't in the past than it would be if it had just landed on black 10 times in a row. It doesn't change anything. In in sports, obviously, it's not exactly the same thing because these are human beings developed delivering these results. But in general, you know, your expectation should not be that things are going to even out. It should be that they're going to, that the player will play at their average level.
Yeah, whatever.
No, I 100% agree that I feel that way if it's a team that I'm supporting.
Right. I mean, I'm just was doing the prep on that game, and I'm like, what, James Harden? And yeah, he only went 3 for 5 in the paint non-restricted that day. But it was, I mean, he missed his first 20 shots in the paint non-restricted this year. I was like, all right,
wow.
That's coming back around. So that actually even more remarkable. When you count mid-range, are you counting paint non-restricted or just mid?
I was talking about all twos.
Yeah, so they're shooting 60% on all twos, and James Harden missed his first 20 in the paint non-restricted.
Yep.
That's ridiculous.
I mean, it helps when you've got Clint Capella shooting 69%, Nene 68%. So, they've got some things figured out.
All right, your quick take. Cleveland concerned or not?
There's a part of me that feels like people are going to be saying, oh, it's still too early to worry about them right up until the moment they lose.
I think that you should worry about them. They lost a good player, and they added 2 bad players.
Are you counting Jay Crowder as a bad player?
No,
you're just going Wade and Rose?
Yeah. Dwayne Wade was the 3rd most negatively impactful offensive player in the league last year, other than Zach Randolph and Nikolai Vukovic. And Nikolai Vukovic had an exorcism, evidently, in the offseason, and is a totally different player. Like, his change, by the way, I don't know if it's still going on, but early in the year, Nikolai Vukovic's change from what he was a year ago to is now was like Steph Curry and Kevin Durant combined, almost, impactful.
He's a totally new player. His name is pronounced Nikola Vucevic, apparently.
Oh, yeah. My bad. But, like, I was excited.
Yes, it is still going on. He's got a 58.4 true shooting percentage, which, by the way, is there any center in the league right now who's not shooting threes? Is Rudy shooting threes in practice?
No, he's not, actually. Derek Favors has a 3 in 4 straight games, though.
I did take note of that the other night when last night when I saw him make one.
And by the way, your theory of just
3 already this year.
Your theory of just keep shooting threes and having a positive impact. We tried that last night; it didn't work.
I didn't say it was going to work for one game sample necessarily.
Oh, sorry, we tried though. Donovan Mitchell really tried.
He gave it the old college try. That's for sure.
Yes. All right. And then I had. Oh, is Memphis real?
I don't know. I mean, they defend so well, despite having lost, you know, presumably their best defender in terms of Tony Allen. They also have a remarkable knack of finding players who like reek poorly in terms of box score stats, but yet the team plays well on the court when they're on the court. That was, you know, Harrison, and now Dylan Brooks seems to be doing the same thing.
All right, those are the brilliant insights from one Kevin Pelton. Anything you'd like to promote other than where people can reach you and what you have coming up? Those things as well. Yes.
Do you want to promote a competing podcast?
Like Peltoncast or the big one?
The big one.
Well, if you have something really important coming up that's of value to listeners, yes. If it's a arbitrary just thing for the NBA Collective podcast, then I just did it. Come on. I'm willing to give you value if you have something special. If not, I'll just mention the NBA Collective podcast that people can listen to.
Well, we'll try to call it by its name, which is the Hoop Collective.
Oh, gosh. That's my bad. I get Orlando Centers wrong and ESPN podcast wrong. And what else did I get wrong? Probably.
I mean, it's only been through 3 different names. So.
Huh?
I don't see it. It's only been through 3 different names.
Right. Well, and if you've already subscribed, at least you just still get it. The only problem is when I try to talk to Google and Alexa to get the podcast, they're very confused.
Yeah.
All right. Actually, you will think this is funny, and I should really do this off the podcast, but I'm going to do it on the podcast. So my favorite thing right now is what I'm about to do right now and see if it makes you laugh. This wraps up Locked On NBA. Make sure you go listen to Locked On Jazz. You can listen to it on Alexa by simply saying, Alexa, play program Locked On Jazz. Or on Google by saying, okay, Google, play Locked On Jazz. Oh, it worked on Alexa, but not on Google. See, if you do that and someone's listening and has the device near them, it makes it play it.
Oh, nice.
So Locked On Jazz is now playing in the other room on Alexa.
There you go.
See, I find that's not your humor, huh?
Well, I didn't hear it.
Oh, well, it's going over in the other room, like full bore. Hey, Alexa, stop. Oh, there's nothing worse than me blaring in the other room. It's already bad enough I'm blaring myself. All right.
Exactly.
Alexa, stop.
All right, this I definitely find you, bro.
Yeah, because it's me being, and my headphone cord is not long enough for me to get in the other room. Oh, geez, wait 1 second. I got it. We don't have anything more to talk about. This is just me getting flustered. Alexa, stop. Phew. Somebody finally shut me up. That was funny. You didn't even laugh. All right. Give your little plug here for everything.
Kate Tolman on Twitter. ESPN Insider articles. Got that one that we talked about on Free Throw Rate for Stars coming out Thursday. And then if Locke hasn't already done it, the Hoop Collective podcast Tuesdays and Fridays. Taking reader questions.
That is Kevin. That is Kevin Pelton. We adore him. I think he's really pretty cool. I talked about you on another podcast this week, but I won't tell you about that because I made fun of you. All right, that is Locked On NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.